Let me just talk for a couple of minutes about the next couple of weeks. As you know, there are... Let me just make sure this is recording. Okay. I think everything's on. We'll see if the power stays on the whole time and the podcast stays on the whole time and everything works. After this class, tonight what we're going to do is we're going to talk about the American medical workforce and the evolution of the medical workforce. We're going to talk about the public health system here in the United States. We're going to talk a little bit about public health and bioterrorism and emergency preparedness and a range of subjects and how those two stories fit together, workforce, public health, preparedness, etc. The next 3 weeks, we have three more weeks in the class. The next 3 weeks, wait, I heard somebody say something that I'll choose to ignore. The next 3 weeks, we're going to have three guest lecturers for the first hour in each class. And so there's and as a result of sort of scheduling these three guests, we're going to switch around the order a little bit, which we're actually a little behind in anyway. Next week, we're going to discuss health information technology. And we're going to have from about 5:30 to about 6:30 or 6:45, a guy named Bob Challoner, who was the chief executive officer of Cabrini Hospital here in New York City, who rose up through the ranks as an IT person originally, but then really became a general manager. And he's going to talk to you about how a manager, a general manager who's not a particular HIT expert necessarily, how someone like that deals with the challenge of new health information technologies and tries to implement what's appropriate and not just buy the latest and greatest gadget. So he's coming next week, and so we're going to talk about health information technology next week. On April 24th, we're going to talk about quality of care, and we're going to have a guy named Eric Rose, who is the chairman of the surgery department here at Presbyterian Hospital. And he's going to talk about some of the challenges involved in trying to build quality systems into hospitals. And again, he'll be talking for about an hour or so, and then take a few questions. And then the second half of each class, I'll be talking, and what I'm going to probably do on the quality of care day, in addition to following up with some materials I have on quality of care, a few folks emailed me when I asked people what they were interested in hearing about that wasn't on the syllabus, and sort of the majority rules so far, which actually would fit in the quality of care week, was a few people asked if I could talk a little bit about the whole debate about medical malpractice these days, and insurance and the doctors getting, you know, a raw deal and not getting a raw deal. So I'm going to talk a little bit about that on the 24th as well. Then on May 1st, which is our last class, Jeffrey Sachs will be here at 5:30. And Jeff is going to talk about efforts. You know, Jeff works, aside from running the Earth Institute here at Columbia, he also is Kofi Annan's chief health advisor and has worked very closely with the United Nations and with, you know, the Global Fund to help set up the Global Fund and do a whole variety of things which are designed to try to encourage the developed world, the wealthy, industrialized, developed world, to provide more resources, more aid, more assistance to countries in sub-Saharan Africa and other places around the world which have tremendous needs and are dealing with HIV/AIDS, malaria, tuberculosis, and a whole other host of issues and problems. So Jeff will be here on May 1st, again from about 5:30 to 6:15. And then what I'm going to do after he leaves in the last half of that class is talk about sort of the view, what I have here in the syllabus, comparative health, the view from other industrialized countries. So he's going to talk a little bit about the United States and industrialized countries vis-a-vis the developing world, and then I'm going to talk a little bit about some lessons to be learned from whether it's England, Canada, Australia, etc. So that's the next 3 weeks. Since we have three guests, since they're all pretty interesting people, and since I've encouraged them to come to this class, I really encourage you strongly to come to all three. Number one, because I think you'll learn something from all three of them. It's three very interesting interesting guys who have a lot of interesting things to say. And I've heard them speak before, and they're good speakers, and I don't think that'll be an issue. And number two, I think we have a pretty good turnout tonight. I mean, it seems like most people are here, but I know toward the end of the semester, there's no final exam in this class. There's just the final paper. there's a tendency sometimes as we get toward the end of the semester when you know you don't have an exam here and that you may be writing a paper on nothing to do with, you know, health information technology, quality, or, you know, AIDS in Africa. And so you say, well, why should I even bother showing up? Well, number one, show up because it's interesting and important. Number two, show up because I really want you to show up on those days. It would not look good if only half the class was here and we had those folks come. I also sent you an email last week, I guess, at some point last week, giving you the topic for the third memo that you're writing. Third memo is on comparative systems, and the assignment is really to pick a country, any country. You get to write about the pick the country you want to write about, but in 500 words, you know, and it shouldn't be significantly less than 500 words. I mean, I think it'd be really tough to do this in 150 words, but I really don't want you to write more than 500 words. In 500 words, write basically a two-page memo, which is, you know, a couple of double-spaced pages, on a little bit of background of that country and one issue or policy in that country that you think is interesting and has either some lessons or some applicability to the United States. And I think part of the task there is for you to learn a little something about a foreign country. Part of the task there is for you to be able to write a memo that's pretty short, in which, as if you were writing to a, you know, and again, it's, you don't have to write it necessarily in memo form, but it's as if you really wanted to educate a policymaker, and you had to do it pretty quickly, because they're not going to read 5-6 pages, and they're certainly not going to read 15-20 pages. They might not read more than a page, but 2 pages, I think, for this assignment is good. So that's the task for that third memo, which I believe is due on the 24th at the beginning of class. And then I've actually, and I know the teaching assistants have as well, I've actually been hearing from a number of you about your term papers, and I assume, expect that many, if not most, if not all of you have begun working on that by this point. You've thought about it. You know, you've thought about it. But it's actually, you know, getting closer to crunch time there as well, too. So feel free to get back in touch with me or any of the teaching assistants on that also. Any questions before we... Yeah?
When you say background on the country that we're going to be doing for the next memo due, what kind of background...
Background that's relevant to the issue you're talking about. So, yeah, no, I don't want to know the, you know... All I want to know is background that's relevant to the issue. So if you're writing about, you know, somebody came to my office today and mentioned that she was going to write about a foreign country that has a tremendous problem with HIV/AIDS and some of the policies they've been pursuing along those lines, you don't have to tell me, you know, what you have to tell me is why HIV is such a problem in that country. What, you know, what's caused, you know, what's the issue there, and what's the background to the context around HIV? I don't need to know about, you know, their school system. I mean, again, if it's relevant that they're very poor, you could say they're a very poor country with an average gross domestic product of X. You know, if you're writing about some country's system for national health insurance, you can give a little bit of background as to, you know, how they got that system. But again, it's not a historical paper. It's basically, this is the system that they have. This is, you know, the lesson for the United States, and here's what I think is interesting and important about it. Good. You don't have a lot of room in 500 words, you know, to say too much. So you really have to say something that's relevant to the topic. Any other questions either on the short memo, the longer paper, or the next few weeks? Yeah?
When will we see our papers from
last? Okay, the papers from last time are, I think, just about all graded. I've got most of them. I'm waiting for one batch, but I've got almost all of them in my office. I just have to go through them and sort of enter the grades and sort of look at, I sort of randomly audit, you know, some of the ones that the teaching assistants have gone through and look at some of those. So I would think that they'll be available, and I'll send you an email about this, but I would think that they'll be available in the health policy management offices by tomorrow afternoon, Wednesday morning at the absolute latest, but hopefully by tomorrow afternoon. And we also should be able to post the grades, in sort of the CourseWorks gradebook by tomorrow afternoon, so that even if you can't get to HPM to pick up the paper tomorrow afternoon, you should at a minimum be able to see your grade. Any other questions before we start? Okay. So let me start today, and in a certain sense where I'm going to start today is one of the places we started at the very beginning of the semester, which is that government, when government was trying to think about its role in the healthcare system here in the United States, it started with public health. It started with public health. I mean, the first tasks that government, and it was primarily local governments, cities, counties, the first task that government took upon itself in the 18th century, in the 19th century, was to try to deal with the problem of infectious disease, to deal with epidemics, whether it was TB or yellow fever or scarlet fever or all the various different smallpox, all the different kinds of epidemics that were creating such huge loss of life and huge serious disease and was spreading like wildfire through many of the cities in the 18th and 19th century. Local governments during the 18th and 19th century spent a lot of effort and a lot of time trying to think about and develop systems that would improve the water supply, that would improve the food supply, that would improve the air supply, that would deal with waste on the streets, that would deal with rodents, deal with basic public health issues that affected all, particularly in big cities here in the United States. And so government started with public health. And it was local government that did that start. And those local governments, again, as we've talked about a little bit in this class already, were pretty darn effective, given the restrictions and the limitations that they were dealing with at the time, given the state of the medical technology at the time. They were pretty darn effective in dealing with those problems and setting up systems, in dealing with infectious disease. Over the next 100-150 years, throughout the 19th century and first half of the 20th century, to the extent government played a role in the healthcare system here in the United States, it remained primarily around protecting public health. And we've covered that already earlier in the semester. But where things begin to change dramatically is in the middle of the 20th century, in the 1930s, 1940s, 1950s, 1960s. Things begin to change dramatically during that era because government begins to say to itself, you know what? We've spent some time and we've spent some resources on public health, but we've accomplished that job. We've done pretty well. We've pretty much wiped out many infectious diseases. We've pretty much put in place systems for enforcing clean water, clean air, clean food, clean sewage systems. What we think is far more interesting to us as a role for government and far sexier in terms of our dollars to be spent is to shift our interest away from public health toward these new medical interventions, these new medical technologies that began to spring up like wildfires in the 1940s and 1950s. And so beginning sort of in the post-World War II era, and that's where I really want to start the story today. Beginning in the post-World War II era, the federal government begins to get involved in healthcare really for the first time in the couple hundred year history of the United States. And the federal government says, you know, sure, we'll have a little Food and Drug Administration, we'll deal with, we'll work with, you know, local communities and local health departments a little bit. You know, sure, we'll deal a little bit with immigration and we'll deal a little bit with infectious disease, but the heart and soul of the federal action beginning in the 1940s, the heart and soul of the federal dollar beginning in the 1940s, the heart and soul of the reason the federal government got significantly involved in healthcare beginning in the 1940s was not to deal with public health, was not to deal with health insurance. We've already talked about how they said, you know, maybe we'll try to help build up a private health insurance system, but our goal is not to have government-funded health insurance in the United States. Instead, the heart and soul of what the federal government was interested in doing beginning in the 1940s was building up the institutional capacity to deliver the new healthcare technologies that we believed would cure and solve all major illnesses here in the United States. There was, and around the world, there was post-World War II here in the United States, a real era of optimism, a real era of scientific breakthrough, a real era of change. And the federal government says our role is to nurture medical researchers, to nurture medical science, and then to find an institutional vehicle for delivering to the average person across America the fruits of that scientific advancement. So you see, for example, post-World War II, a tremendous infusion of federal dollars into the National Institutes for Health. The goal? Nurture and spur medical research, which now we believe can wipe out cancer, can wipe out heart disease, can wipe out all of these kinds of chronic and long-term illnesses, that for the first time, there's a sense, can be dealt with by science and by medical advances. 1946, the first major federal health care program in America, in American history, is the Hill-Burton Act. And we've mentioned Hill-Burton in passing once or twice over this semester. What was Hill-Burton? What was Hill-Burton? Remind me. Yeah.
Expand dramatically the number of hospital beds in the U.S.
Right. The goal was we want to put a hospital in every rural and inner city community in the United States. We want to spread the delivery system of the hospital. We want to make available to all Americans the fruits of this new medical technology. Where do we do that? We do it in the hospital. So the federal government said, we will come up with money. We will fund, we will finance the creation and the expansion of hospitals across the United States, so much so that we developed a huge oversupply of hospital beds here in the United States. Institutional bias. Jump ahead 20 years, Medicare and Medicaid, which we've talked about from your point of view, probably ad nauseum this semester. Medicare and Medicaid. Medicare basically said to the hospitals, we will pay you whatever you want, whatever you charge. And Medicaid said to the hospitals, we too will pay you whatever you want, and you're the only provider that will have such most favored provider status. Every other kind of provider, doctors, nursing homes, community health centers, labs, x-ray technicians, and the like, every other kind of provider, the state got to decide. The states got to decide how much they were going to pay those providers. Hospitals, though, the federal government said, no, you, the states, you have to pay the hospital whatever it charges. It's reasonable costs. It's reasonable charges. So first federal action, first major federal foray into the healthcare system here in the United States was to build up and to help create an enormous institutional bias in the American healthcare system. At the same time, funding for public health, those classic old-fashioned, you know, on-the-ground-driven activities that local governments had been engaging in for the previous 150 years, funding for public health activities began to dry up. And the federal government was certainly not interested in helping local communities out. Instead of a population-based public health approach, the federal government in the 1940s said, we want a medically based, a medically focused institutional approach. So you had the rise of institutionalism and the decaying, the beginning of the decaying of the public health infrastructure. Early 1960s comes along, and the federal government says something else. Federal policymakers say something else. They say, you know what? Not only do we want a hospital in every community, but we want a doctor and lots of doctors in every one of those darn hospitals. And we want those hospitals to have training programs so they could train the residents to be tomorrow's doctors. So beginning in the 1960s, the federal government simultaneously decides there's a physician shortage and that we need to dramatically expand the number of doctors here in the United States. And they also decide that the place we want to train those doctors, the hospital-based setting, is something that we, the federal government, should finance. So we want more docs, and we want the federal government to finance those docs. So how do we get more docs? It's mid-1960s now, and you're a federal policymaker, and you want more docs. What do you do? Wait, I can't. Somebody, I heard a voice. Yeah. Well, one thing you can do is you can give prospective medical students at a minimum low-interest loans and perhaps even full grants so you can make it more financially affordable. And in fact, the federal government established a whole program in the 1960s of low-interest loans and grants for prospective medical students. So you make it easier to afford it. Yeah, what else do you do? You can, absolutely, you can make it easier for the students to afford medical school. Yep, what else? Yep.
Open floodgates for foreign trained.
You could change immigration laws. You could change immigration laws to make it easier both for American-born but foreign-trained physicians to practice here in the United States and also for foreign-trained, foreign-born and foreign-trained physicians to practice here in the United States. I mean, who knows, just roughly, I think it might have been in the Covenant chapter, but what percentage of residents in American hospitals today do you think are foreign-trained? Anybody know? It's more than 20. It's over 25%. The American medical, and doctors here in the United States, it's about 27-28%. About 27-28% of physicians here in the United States were trained abroad. Again, either American-born who go abroad for school or foreign-born, foreign-trained. So there was significant changes to immigration policy to encourage and allow an infusion of foreign-trained docs here into the United States. That began mid-1960s. Any other strategies? What else can you do? Yeah?
Draft exemption.
You can give a draft exemption, particularly during a war, like Vietnam, the Vietnam era. You could say to people, you know what, you go to medical school, you don't have to go off to Vietnam. You can also, yeah. You could try to make it more lucrative to become a doctor, although I think by the 1960s, the medical profession was already pretty prestigious and pretty lucrative, and it was sort of the heyday of physician autonomy and physician income, you know, in which doctors, particularly once Medicare and Medicaid were enacted, then you pretty much had a situation in which docs, you know, could charge whatever they want, both to public payers and private payers, and get paid pretty high fees. Way in the back, yeah. You can, absolutely, you could try to reduce the barriers. One of the kinds of barriers that we talked about is reducing financial barriers through loans, grants, and the like. But you can also say, and this is very similar to what you were saying, you can also say, you know what, in addition to having more foreign-trained physicians, we want more medical schools in the United States. We want more medical school slots in the United States. And how do you get more medical school slots? Well, one thing that the federal government did in the mid-1960s was they called up the deans of all the medical schools, and they said, you know what, if you add 30 slots, 50 slots, 75 slots, we will subsidize those additional slots. We will give you bonuses. We will give you money. We will give you grants to hire new faculty, to build new buildings, to expand the size of your medical school pool. So we went here in the United States from a situation in which the American medical schools, forget the foreign trained schools for a second, and I'm, you know, the American medical schools were graduating about 8,000 students a year. And within a decade, we doubled that. You know, by mid-70s, they were graduating 16,000 a year. So pretty much overnight, you doubled the supply of medical school slots here in the United States. You made it easier to afford going to those medical schools. And if you had trouble getting into one of those medical schools, or if you just decided you wanted to study abroad, or if you were foreign-born and foreign-trained, we made it easier for you to practice here in the United States. So through all of those strategies, the federal government implemented a conscious effort to dramatically expand the physician supply here in the United States, with the goal of having that walk hand in hand with the dramatically expanded hospital supply. The idea was, let's have more docs, let's put them in the hospitals, let's get them around the country. And let me just, let's see, in terms of numbers, yeah.
This sounds like a lot of goodwill, but you know, it always seems like there are political agendas behind a lot of public health.
What was politically driving it was, I think, the hospital industry and the institutional bias in the system. You know, yeah, a couple of comments. Right. Right. Well, clearly, one of the lessons, for example, of the federal effort to build up the hospital supply in the United States was we ended up with too many hospitals. One of the ongoing debates, and this is a debate today still in 2006, because, you know, a lot of policymakers have concluded that there's another physician shortage today, and there's a lot of pressure on medical schools and foundations are pushing. There's a big push today in 2006 for federal policies, again, to expand the pool of physicians. And one of the ongoing debates is whether or not that's a role that the federal government should be playing or not. Is it part of the role of the federal government to try to regulate the physician supply in the country? Is it part of the role of the federal government, and we're going to talk about this a lot in a few minutes, to try to regulate the specialty choices of physicians? Are those federal roles, are those state roles, or are those simply private sector roles? And there's a tremendous disagreement about that. And clearly, if there's, you know, 200 people in this room, I'm sure there's a variety of opinion in this room. And it's, you know, I'm not going to say there's a right answer to that. Sort of depends on what you feel. I mean, it's certainly the case that European countries regulate very tightly the physician supply and the specialty choices of their medical workforce. Whether or not that's something we should be doing here in the United States, and whether it's had a positive or negative impact, is certainly debatable. Yeah.
You had said that our government wanted to go towards an institutionally based medical system, and with the result, decay of the public health system. But it was my impression that during that same period of time, that a great number of medical students actually became part of the public health service to finance that medical education, with a resultant very large increase in the size of the public health service.
Okay, a couple of things. We're going to talk in just a couple of minutes, and I'm going to come back to your point about the National Health Service Corps. We're going to talk about sort of the public health service corps, and we're going to talk about the geographic maldistribution of docs. It's certainly the case, particularly in the 1970s, that a significant number of medical students had their medical school education financed by the government in exchange for a commitment to work in medically underserved communities. It's also the case that a lot of the doctors who were allowed to immigrate into the country, who were foreign-born, foreign-trained, had as one of the immigration criteria that they practice in a medically underserved community. Those are both facts. At the same time, it's also the case that during the 1960s and during the 1970s and during the 1980s, as the supply of docks doubled, I mean, we went from, well, not quite doubled, but we went from 157 docks for every 100,000 Americans in 1971 to 244 docks for every 100,000 Americans, 15 years later. That's a big increase in supply, and it's for every 100,000. At the same time that we increased the supply, we also found ourselves in a situation in which both what you would call specialty maldistribution and what you would call geographic maldistribution both worsened. And what I mean by that, let me sort of walk through that real quickly. When I say specialty maldistribution, what I mean is that the large majority of those new docs that were trained in the 60s, 70s, and 80s decided they didn't want to be generalists. They didn't want to be family practice docs. They didn't want to be general internal medicine docs. They didn't want to be general pediatric docs. They wanted to be neurologists, cardiologists, dermatologists. They wanted to specialize. And so one of the phenomena that began to happen significantly in the 70s and 80s was the healthcare system became much, much more specialized. And we went from a situation in the 1950s where two-thirds to three-quarters of the American medical physician workforce were generalists to a situation where those numbers flipped 20 years later. Now, let me just, before we even get to geographic maldistribution, let me ask why it is you think that most docs went into the specialties in the 60s, 70s, and 80s. Yeah. Number one is technology. Clearly, there was changes in medical technology. Yep.
Where the money was.
That's where the money was. Clearly, it's money. What else? Yeah. It's you can lifestyle issues. I mean, if you're a family practice doc, if you're a primary care doc, you often have to respond, day and night. Yeah.
The body of medical knowledge was geometrically increasing, so it was more difficult to know everything.
Being a primary care doc became increasingly difficult. I mean, there was, and this was a trend not simply in medicine. I practiced law for 8 years here in New York City. Over time, many, if not most, of the lawyers who I started out with began to specialize either in tax law or real estate law or criminal law or corporate law or legal services law, whatever it was. The sociologists will talk about as fields become more complex, there are inherent incentives to specialize. So that's another reason. What else? Yeah. Professional societies grew increasingly strong, and those professional societies had a major impact in medical schools, so that the culture of the medical school, the curriculum of the medical school, the role models of the medical school, and the recruitment efforts of the medical school were all designed to produce, to find that kid who'd always wanted to be a doctor since he was 5 years old, who was interested in science, who wanted to be the medical researcher that would get the NIH grant, that would work in the hospital, that would cure cancer. That was sort of the goal of the medical schools and the culture. And I've actually, I'm not a doc, I didn't go to medical school, but I've certainly spoken to enough, and I'd be curious if any of you, and I think things have changed a little bit in the 90s and the 2000s. But I know a lot of docs who went through medical school in the 70s and 80s who were told, you're too smart to be a primary care doc. Don't sell yourself short. You should become a neurosurgeon, not just for the money, not just for the prestige, but for the intellectual rigor of specializing, the intellectual joy of sort of dealing with the latest and the greatest technological advances. Yeah. Oh, sure. Absolutely.
Like, my institution was basically specialty, so everybody went to some kind of specialty or surgery.
No, I mean, I think East Carolina, for example, has a medical school, which the goal of the medical school is to produce family practice docs. That's unusual. And particularly, sort of the more prestigious the medical school, the more the culture accentuated the specialties, the high tech, you know, and sort of advancing through that route. Yeah.
And the changes in the pattern of diseases, you know, as people live longer, infectious diseases were under control, more chronic diseases.
Absolutely. You know, I mean, I think, you know, again, it's not, none of these trends should be a surprise. I mean, as technology advanced, you know, as the world became more specialized, as our knowledge, you know, about particular illnesses became more advanced, as the money was there, as the prestige was there, as the hospitals wanted the, you know, the specialized residencies, as the, you could often have more control over whoever was talking about lifestyle and schedule in a specialty. All of those things, you know, contributed to the culture, which I think emphasized specialization, emphasized high tech, emphasized research, and de-emphasized primary care, de-emphasized generalist practice of medicine, and de-emphasized the devalued, not just financially, but devalued intellectually, the task, which, as was pointed out, is often more difficult, of being a primary care physician. So that trend that we would call specialty maldistribution became increasingly prevalent through the 70s and 80s. Another trend that became increasingly prevalent through the 70s and 80s was what was called geographic maldistribution. The assumption, and here you get back to sort of market-based economics, and in this particular case, how the market-based assumption didn't work effectively. The assumption was, if we build up the supply of doctors significantly, if we sort of provide incentives and encouragement and finances, you know, for more and more docs, if we do that, market-based economics, market-based forces are going to suggest that all those docs can't practice on Fifth Avenue. You know, that some of those docs are going to end up having to practice in rural America. Some of those docs are going to have to practice in medically underserved communities. We'll just have more and more docs, and laws of supply and demand would suggest that those docs over time would disperse themselves across the country, thereby reducing geographic maldistribution, thereby reducing the number of medically underserved communities in the United States, thereby providing a workforce for these new hospitals that were being created in every rural community around the country, and in every inner city around the country, and every community health center around the country, and every public health clinic around the country. The assumption was more docs, more nurses, more will reduce geographic maldistribution. That assumption actually prompted, you know, a couple of people mentioned the National Health Service Corps. The National Health Service Corps was established in the early 1970s, also in an effort to reduce geographic maldistribution. The National Health Service Corps, as a couple of you have pointed out, it's kind of like the old Northern Exposure, was that the TV show where, you know, the kid from the Bronx goes off to Alaska or whatever it was and, you know, meets all sorts of interesting, quirky characters practicing medicine. The National Health Service Corps basically said to young prospective medical students, we will help finance, either through loan forgiveness, through grants, we will help finance your medical education if indeed you go off and practice for a couple of years in a medically underserved community. And during the 1970s, the National Health Service Corps was pretty effective. It actually did provide, and I think we talked about this when we talked about community health centers, it did provide, by the late 1970s, early 1980s, over half of the medical workforce of community health centers here in the United States came via the National Health Service Corps. And yet, even with the National Health Service Corps, geographic maldistribution was getting worse. And then, along come the early 1980s, and the National Health Service Corps is essentially defunded. Is essentially defunded during the early part of the Reagan administration. And geographic maldistribution gets even worse. And so by the late 1980s, early 1990s, we were in a situation in which we had more and more docs, more and more specialists, higher and higher medical care costs, more and more geographic maldistribution, and an increasing lack of clarity about whether the government should do something about it or the marketplace could handle it and should handle it. A complete lack of clarity about the best way forward and the role government should follow, the path government should follow under any scenario. Policy analysts in the late 80s started saying, you know what? The reason, a good part of the reason that healthcare costs are rising so fast, that healthcare costs are rising so dramatically, is because the system is becoming increasingly specialized. Why is that? Why do you think it would be the case that as the system becomes increasingly specialized, it also becomes increasingly expensive? Yeah.
The more specialists there are, the more special procedures they do.
That's right. I mean, the more, you know, specialists by nature want to perform their specialist tool. You know, they want to implement their specialist tools. Specialists by nature practice a more expensive form of medicine than do generalists. When specialists, you've got a lot of cardiologists who have a small primary care practice in addition to their cardiology practice. And there's clear evidence that the cost, when a cardiologist has a primary care practice in addition to his heart practice, the cost of that primary care practice is going to be significantly higher than the cost of the primary care practice of a family practice doc. And it's going to be even more significantly higher than the family than the primary care practice of a non-physician provider, such as a nurse practitioner or a physician's assistant. Part of it is salaries. Part of it is procedures and the number of procedures and the intensity of procedures. Part of it is fear of defensive medicine. I mean, fear of malpractice and not fear of defensive medicine, engagement in defensive medicine, ordering every test possible. But the assumption among many sort of liberal democratic types in the late 80s, early 90s, that actually were advising people like Bill Clinton when he was running for president in 1992, the assumption was if you want to do health reform, if you want to reduce the cost of health care here in the United States, if you want national health insurance, if you want to reform the health care system in the United States, one of the first things you have to do is deal with specialty maldistribution. And one of the second things you have to do is deal with geographic maldistribution. Because you know what? If we train two specialists and both those specialists happen to practice on Fifth Avenue, people are going to travel to Fifth Avenue and they're going to find them and they're going to use them and they're going to cost money. And so as Bill Clinton is running for president in the late 80s and early 1990s, as Bill Clinton is thinking about health reform and a health reform agenda, as Bill Clinton is thinking about universal health insurance, as Bill Clinton is thinking about health care cost containment and balanced budgets, Clinton and his advisors also start thinking, I don't think it's the battery. I think, did it just go off again? He says it's shorting out somehow or another. This is a real pain. Is it back on now? So you come to a fancy institution like Columbia, and you can't even get the darn thing to... All right, everybody go home. No, just kidding. No, you can't. You didn't hear that either. All right, I'll go over to the podium. Let me see, is this on? It is on. Keeps popping off.
Keep us having a fundraiser this morning. If you guys would like to come down, it's going to be a happy hour at Radio Perfecto on Amsterdam Ave at 118th Street. There'll be people from all different grad schools and it'll be pretty special. So $50 grass, $50 grass, and some other ones. So you guys should come out.
It should be okay.
We want to help support one of our projects in Central America, empowering women through education and enterprise. Thanks.
All right, I guess it must just be shorting out. I don't know if that...
Yeah, well, I changed the battery, so...
All right, well, we're going to try again. Thanks a lot. Okay, so let me summarize a little bit of where we were before the break. We went through a situation in the 1980s and late 1980s. We found ourselves in a situation in the late 1980s in which there was a significant increase in specialty maldistribution here in the United States. More and more medical students were looking to go to sort of high-tech specialties. Fewer and fewer were interested in generalist professions. We found ourselves in a situation in which the geographic maldistribution of docs seem to be getting worse and worse. And even with the best efforts of the National Health Service Corps, even with Medicaid, even with all of those kinds of activities that government was engaging in, the problems seem to be getting worse. We found ourselves in a situation in which the public health community here in the United States was increasingly divided over whether or not the role for public health agencies ought to be to provide direct services, direct care services to low-income populations in medically underserved communities, or if that was simply a distraction from the true and important public health role of conducting epidemiological studies and population-based activities. We found ourselves in a situation in which the public health infrastructure was determined to be, by the IOM and by other analysts around the country, drastically underfunded, drastically without adequate resources, with an aging and inadequate workforce, aging and inadequate laboratories, and more. And so enter into the picture sort of a Clinton proposal which he says is going to solve all these problems. And again, the way he says we're going to solve these problems is we're going to require that there only be 105 to 110% of graduating medical students. Only that amount would be allowed to have first-year residencies. 55% of them would have to be generalists, and the federal government would allocate them all over the country. Yeah, question. Well, I think there were a couple of different questions there. One question is, how will this affect medical schools? You know, Clinton would argue this would have no direct effect on medical schools. He was talking about the residencies, not the medical schools. But I think to the extent the assumption is that it's in academic medical centers that a lot of the residencies take place, the argument was that there are medical schools around the country, that those medical schools would expand, and the academic medical centers in those communities would expand, and the hospitals would expand, and that would be good in terms of the geographic maldistribution of docs. I mean, what he was saying is he was arguing at the time, and there were policy analysts arguing at the time, that we have too many docs, and that we have to spread them across the country more equitably and more accurately and more fairly, and that will actually lead to reduced waiting times, not expanded waiting times, because people in rural America will have access to docs and residents that they previously didn't have. I mean, let me just ask you, before we talk more about the Clinton proposal, why is it that you think geographic maldistribution was and is such a big problem. Why do we have, you know, lots of docks on Fifth Avenue and no docks in sort of rural America? I mean, what is it that's causing such significant geographic maldistribution? Yeah.
Well, besides the financial incentives, most docks set up their practice, their home, where they train, because they meet people that can give them jobs. They develop a relationship with the community where they train, and it's just easier.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Anybody else? Yeah,
in the back. Actually, that's not really financial incentive, because in some rural areas they actually pay more for you to stay there. So it's not necessarily financial incentive. It's more also the patient population and mass training education that you're actually going to see. I mean, one of the things about New York City, why there's probably so many training programs here, is like right now I'm applying for infectious disease. And this is a market where a lot of the people who are doing infectious disease would want to be, because of the tropical medicine, the international feel. And so it just, I mean, you're not going to be able to get that training, let's say, in rural Nebraska, as I already mentioned, which I took out originally from Nebraska, but I would say the same thing in Texas. I'm not going to see the same amount of, like, tropical medicine. I'm not going to see malaria. I'm not going to see all these different that right. You would see up here versus over there. So it's also the training that you're getting at that institution that you're not necessarily going to get from just getting from the feedback from the professors or reading books or, you know, which is what Clinton wants to do, which I don't really think or wanted to do, which I really think is really going to provide the same amount of training and education as actually seeing and actually doing it, which mm-hmm. you're not going to be able to do that in some institutions, unfortunately.
Mm-hmm. I mean, and I think infectious disease is the perfect example of that. I suppose, you know, you could make the argument that other specialties, whether it's cardiology or orthopedics or neurology, you don't have the numbers in other parts of the country that you might have in New York City, but you have you see the same problems. You see the same problems. In the back, was there a comment? Yeah. Very what?
I said it isn't very, she's so smart. Particularly astute. But New York is a hard place to leave, I think, and the conveniences of the cities, in, you know, like the crowds that the
Hey, New York's cool. No, I mean, but, you know, listen, I think all of the things, yeah, yeah. She thinks your comment is really good, by the way. Yeah.
Doctors aren't trained in business and don't want to set up their own practices. They'd rather join the framework.
Okay. Any other comments? Yeah.
I was confused about the second to last comment, and I don't know, maybe I didn't hear it all the way. Like, are you trying to say that, like, your kids wouldn't get educated?
Listen, I think there's no question, and in fact studies have found this to be the case, that, you know, there's a lot of reasons for geographic maldistribution. One is it's tougher to make money in rural areas than it is in big cities, even with some rural communities maybe paying a little more money, at least in private insurance. That's actually generally not the case. Medicaid doesn't pay a lot of money in rural areas. It's tough to find in underserved communities. It's hard to make it on Medicaid, and there's administrative hassles and so on and so forth. But if you talk to a lot of people and you read the literature, the biggest issue in finding docs, and for rural communities anyway, is lifestyle issues. It is lifestyle issues. it's much easier actually to recruit docs to medically underserved communities in New York City, where docs can, say, practice medicine in a really low-income community, but still, you know, maybe live in that community, but also maybe get in their car and go to the suburbs at the end of the day, as opposed to living in a very rural community. And so what a lot of, and I think a lot of what happens is young docs will start out often in rural communities, but then when they get married and when they have kids, whether it's because of schools, whether it's because of cultural issues, whatever, oftentimes, whether it's because of access to other specialists and other docs and sort of a community of docs, many of them don't want to stay in rural America. I was working on a project in which I was in rural Texas, a very rural area in Texas, and I was asking some folks at Community Health Center how they try to recruit, you know, how they find docs, you know, who are willing to come, or nurse practitioners, or anyone, how they find people who are willing to come, you know, and live in their community and practice medicine in their community. And, you know, the number one thing that they look for is they look for doctors who like to hunt. You know, I mean, you know, they look for doctors who want to hunt and who want to fish and who want that lifestyle. You know, not everybody, I mean, it is true that not everybody wants to, you know, take their kid to the Metropolitan Museum and then off to the opera at night. You know, there are people who like to be in a situation where they can do the kinds of things that you do in rural America. But it's tougher to find. And a lot of communities have these sort of grow your own projects right now where they'll pay for, like, local kids to go off to college or medical school on the assumption that the local kid will then come back to their community. And while it's true that those local kids are more likely to come back to rural Montana than some kid who grew up in the Bronx, a lot of those kids who grew up in rural Montana and then go off to medical school and then do their residencies in New York City don't want to go back to rural Montana, you know, for whatever reason. So it's not sort of a, you know, a value judgment at all on life. And again, you know, I mean, my wife would kill me if she thought I was making, you know, she's from a very rural farming community in Indiana. And yet this isn't just docs. I mean, a lot of those communities are finding it hard to keep their younger populations more generally, particularly farming areas where kids used to, I mean, the kids would grow up and they would become farmers. That was the way it used to be. Or they'd grow up and there was one factory in town where that factory is often closing now. It's very tough to recruit in those areas. Yeah.
What part of Texas is one thing, and then the other thing is I am from, you know, the south area of Texas, basically, and there were a lot of programs where down in South Texas they would try to get a lot of the people from there go into higher education and go back and train there. But unfortunately, what happened there, a lot of the push, there ended up being a lot of high malpractice rates. And I'm actually from Corpus Christi, where there were no neurosurgeons there for a long period of time just because of the malpractice. And so that's one of the issues that also came up. So a lot of people that I know who were from that area never went back because of also that's one of the issues that come up also.
Well, we'll talk about the malpractice issue is actually pretty complicated. And there's a lot of mythology about malpractice. I mean, there's a lot of interstate variation, but it's not really a question of rural versus urban, at least when you look at the data. But we'll definitely come back to that because it's an interesting point that you make. Yeah?
Professionally, you want to deal with more population to have variety, mm-hmm. but that's more challenging. So if you go to rural, the population is very small,
right,
and that does not give you that.
Well, I mean, so this raises a question. I mean, we'll get back to the Clinton proposal in a minute and what happened with the Clinton proposal. But, I mean, for example, National Health Service Corps. You know, one of the benefits of the National Health Service Corps was that it would end up placing young docs in medically underserved communities, both in rural and in inner city communities. If you talk to folks in those communities, and I'm no expert on this, I've spoken to some and I've read some, but I'm no real expert on it. But the sense I get is that there were kind of mixed feelings in those communities. On the one hand, they were very happy to have a doc. They're very happy to have someone there. On the other hand, so the constant rotation, because a lot of those docs would not stay beyond their year or two commitment. And so the constant changing of docs was an issue. The fact that a lot of those docs didn't speak the language, didn't know the culture, were really sort of coming in from the outside was an issue. On the other hand, they were grateful to have him. So, I mean, it was sort of a mixed blessing in that sense. But let me just throw out there and ask a question. And again, we'll come back to Clinton and sort of what's happened post-Clinton in a minute. But if you were going to try to come up with a policy to think about sort of dealing with the fact of medically underserved communities, what would that policy be? Anybody have any ideas? I mean, I'll tell you what, I didn't wait 7 seconds there. You know? See, I find it so hard to wait, so I'm going to wait. Yeah, see? Okay.
Pay them the same thing as they pay in New York.
Excuse me?
Pay the same
rates as New York?
Pay in New York, so they have more money to pay.
Okay, you could try to increase now. Yeah.
I think you'd have to pay a lot more. Yeah. Because people who go there who might want everything that New York has to offer are going to have the means with which to go there and visit.
Well, again, when you talk about pay them more, who's paying the bill in this situation? I mean, it's, you know, if you're talking about Medicaid or Medicare or government-funded payers, you know, the odds that Medicaid is going to pay, you know, that the Texas Medicaid Department is going to dramatically increase the amount of money that they pay to primary care docs in rural communities to draw them there, is pretty nil. I mean, that's probably not going to happen. And if you're talking about privately insured, they're going to pay market rates. I mean, it's... Yeah.
Well, I didn't mean to cut you off.
No, that's okay. You didn't cut me off.
I was going to say, I think that the government should make a much more firm commitment in restoring or supplying different regions, medically insured regions, with resources to make them a decent medical center. If you look at Pittsburgh over time, mm-hmm.
Right. Yep. Okay.
I think you should sort of give up on doctors altogether. Mm-hmm.
Absolutely.
Midwives.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. No, I mean, there's no question that probably the most successful efforts so far have involved, I mean, there's the whole rural clinic movement basically is a movement that essentially relies on floating docs. You know, docs to come by maybe one morning a week to rural areas, and the rest of the time, those clinics are, you know, the care is provided either by nurse practitioners or by nurses or by physician's assistants, and they end up providing sort of the majority of the care, and they sort of hold off on the side, or they have people come in one day a week when there's something more serious or when they think they need help. Other people, yeah, way in the back, did you have a comment? Uh-huh. Sir, he was saying he would try to, and again, there are rules about this already, but he was saying he would try to encourage more foreign-trained physicians to come into the country and require them to serve in medically underserved communities, particularly in rural areas. Way in the back? Sort of more of sort of the National Health Service Corps type approach. Did you? Right. Okay. Yeah.
I think you might also make it worthwhile for physicians who go to these communities, maybe by decreasing their malpractice insurance and stuff like that.
I mean, that comment was, and that gets back to the comment about malpractice. I mean, there are communities which have tried to provide what's known as sovereign immunity to physicians who practice in low-income communities, because there's a perception among some docs. It's actually not true, but there's a perception among some docs that low-income communities are more likely to sue for malpractice. And so there's often a feeling that if we either pay the malpractice premiums or if we provide some limited sovereign immunity. So states have done that. All of these kinds of ideas states are trying, whether it's national or state health service corps, whether it's rural health clinics that rely on nurse practitioners, whether it's telemedicine. I mean, the idea of sort of bringing, you know, to rural areas sort of the benefits through distance education and distance learning, whether it's sovereign immunity, whether it's sort of grow your own programs where you send your high school kid off to college and off to medical school in the hope or expectation that they'll come back and practice in your community, whether it's Medicaid programs which have tried increasing reimbursement for primary care services to attract more to low-income communities. Medicaid programs have tried that. I mean, I think all of the ideas you're suggesting are good ideas. Yeah.
Uh-huh.
There would be some, or maybe even increase in medical education because of cultural awareness and being able to go to that area and be able to serve that community and be part of that community as a part, as opposed to not, being separate.
Uh-huh.
So, I mean, that's just a hope that, even though it's a rural area, that
right.
Some people would go there, and when they go there, they're actually going to stay there.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, I think one of the things that Clinton was hoping would happen by spreading the residencies across the country, and this gets back to your comment about medical schools, one of the things he was hoping that would happen is, you'd have all these residencies all across the country, so it would sort of create sort of the synergistic activity among medical schools. It would expand medical schools in rural areas, expand residencies in rural areas, expand opportunities and slots in rural areas, so you'd have more people competing, in those rural communities. So, I mean, I think it's certainly similar to what he was talking about. All right, so let's now talk a little bit about the Clinton proposal. So I mentioned to you, again, what Clinton said is cap on the overall number of first-year residencies. 55% of them have to be generalists, and a national board allocates them across the country. So what do you think the politics of that proposal were? What group, name me a group that you think would have an interest in that and what their position would be, pro or con? The medical association. What do you think doctors thought of the proposal?
No.
No, why not? I mean, the notion that the federal government would be determining where residencies were across the country and requiring that 55% of them be generalists. Number one, the medical schools said that would cause us to completely have to change our curriculum, to change our admission practices, to change our enrollment, to change our way of doing business, and we don't want the federal government telling us how to run our medical school. Teaching hospitals who would lose residencies or gain residencies said we don't want the federal government telling us where we can have residencies and how they work and how they don't work and so on and so forth. So the teaching hospitals were opposed, the medical schools were opposed, safety net hospitals were opposed. Why do you think that public hospitals and safety net hospitals were opposed to the Clinton plan? Yeah.
Increase their number of residents as well, decrease their number of people or bodies available.
Well, because safety net hospitals rely significantly on foreign trained physicians. And under the Clinton proposal, there would be far fewer foreign trained physicians here in the United States, and they were worried they were going to lose a prime source of their workforce. So the safety net hospitals were opposed. Medical students were dead set against it because, again, 85% of them were wanting to go to specialty residencies, and now 55% of them were going to have to go to generalist residencies, and they felt as if this was just, downright un-American. It was just forcing them into, residency choices that were not being set by the market and were not reflective of their choices. Who else do you think was opposed to this or for this? Anybody? Anybody else? Yeah. The national insurance companies. Now, that's interesting. Why do you think insurance companies would be opposed to this? Well, it's interesting because about the only advocate and the only ally that Clinton had in this were the managed care companies. because managed care plans actually rely on a very different, they rely much more heavily, they try to rely much more heavily on primary care docs and on generalists, and have far fewer specialists in their network. So the idea of having sort of dealing with specialty maldistribution was something they weren't opposed to. Their thinking was, if there's more primary care specialists, more primary care and less specialty, there's, the cost of the healthcare system is going to go down, and therefore the cost to them is going to go down. Another group, someone mentioned, you know, non-physician providers. What do you think non-physician providers have to say about the Clinton plan? If you had the testimony of the Nurse Practitioner Association, what do you think they would say? Happy with the Clinton plan? No, they were dead set against it. Why do you think they opposed it?
To reduce their usefulness.
Basically, what the non-physician provider said is, look, we don't need 55% of doctors to be generalists engaging in primary care. We nurse practitioners, or we nurses, or we physician's assistants, we could provide primary care services as good as the docs and for a lot cheaper. If anything, said the non-physician providers, you should be moving in the opposite direction. Having a system in which you have fewer generalist physicians, more specialists, and more non-physician providers, so that you'd have a system in which more and more of the primary care was being engaged in and done by the non-physician provider, and then they would rely on the specialist. So the nurse practitioners were saying, we want more nurse practitioners, we don't want more generalist docs. Because if there's more generalist docs, there's no need for nurse practitioners. So they were opposed to it. To the extent that sort of middle class America had a position on this issue, what do you think the position would have been? Go ahead, yeah.
I'm guessing like middle class America is probably saying like, no way, we don't want, you know, you to encourage our doctors to go somewhere else.
Well, two things. Middle-class America was saying no way in also in all the polls that were done. But the reason, the fear that middle-class America had was, you know, a lot of just, if you ask the average person about our healthcare system, they'll say, well, you know, we may have lots of uninsured. It may cost a heck of a lot of money, our system. But you know what? At least we have here in the United States the latest and the greatest and the fanciest technology. You know, we here in the United States have the most advanced systems for dealing with cancer. So the fear that a lot of people, and the reason the average person will say we have that is because we have such a, you know, focus on the specialties. We have such a focus on medical research. We have such a focus on research and development. And, you know, sort of the perspective was, if you sort of drastically slash the number of specialists, you're going to drastically slash the availability of high-tech services, you're going to drastically slash the availability of medical research, and you're going to have a system in which there's just not the same amount of innovation, not the same amount of R&D, and we're going to have all the other problems that we already have, but we're not going to have the benefits of sort of the latest and the best and the greatest medical research. The states were split on the Clinton's proposal. New York State was dead set against it because New York State was going to lose a fortune. I mean, the academic medical community in New York State was going to lose a fortune under the Clinton proposal. I mean, the CEO of Presbyterian and the dean of Columbia Medical School were down in Washington, D.C. every other week advocating against this plan. Because all of the, you know, a lot of the residencies that were here were going to be switched, you know, either to Texas or to Idaho or to Michigan or to Pennsylvania or wherever. You know, so the feeling was this is a real cost loser for New York State. And for the other states, many other states were worried, you know, who knows if there's a national board actually allocating residencies, how that's going to play out. Let's comment way in the back. You would be saying right now, in my medical school, we're educating the finest medical students to become the finest doctors in America. you know, we spend a lot of time thinking about our curriculum. We spend a lot of time thinking about recruiting who we want to recruit. We spend a lot of time bringing together a faculty that represents the best and the brightest of medical educators in the country. And basically, you, the federal government, are going to come in and force a revolution in our medical school, force a revolution in where our medical students want to go, send our medical students elsewhere where they're not going to get as good an education. We're not going to be able to do the kind of medical research we do. And it's going to have adverse effects both for us, clearly, but also for the healthcare system more generally. I think I actually, that was exactly what he said. You know? something like that. All right. So who would be for the Clinton plan? I mean, the managed care plans were sort of, you know, inchy, but who do you think was for the Clinton plan? Excuse me? I mean, maybe some states that were not, that thought they might get some additional residencies out of this.
Community health centers.
Community health centers were nervous about this too because they worried about the loss of foreign trained physicians. They worried about the caps on the number of docs. You know, about the only people that really liked the idea, and I say this, you know, I'm an academic, you know. I work for foundations sometimes, so I could sort of mock myself, I suppose. But the only people who really liked the plan was sort of the public policy analyst types who thought this would be a better quote-unquote system in place. If just overnight we changed the system and we had more generalists, we had fewer specialists, we, you know, divided things up more across the country, it was sort of just going to work out. You know, just overnight we were going to change the way medical schools work, we were going to change the way hospitals were going to work. I mean, it was a very, again, it's kind of like Clinton's proposal for national health insurance. I mean, Clinton is, by all accounts, this extraordinarily savvy politician who, you know, hey, look, John Kerry called him up and asked him for advice, so, you know, but, you know, everybody calls him up. I mean, Democrats across the country call him up, and I've never met the man, but supposedly, you know, he gives great advice to everybody, and he may well be very politically savvy. But when it came to actually thinking about the politics of healthcare reform and the politics of workforce reform, this proposal that he had was just suicidal. I mean, there was no chance in the world that in the Congress in 1993 they were going to enact over the objections of the hospitals, the medical schools, the doctors, the states, you know, the nurse practitioner. I mean, every group imaginable was opposed to this. And you kind of wonder, you know, about the politics of setting it up. And I think where it came from was his assumption that in order to reform a little bit of the system, we have to reform the whole system. We have to do it all at once. We're going to revolutionize the system, and let's just do it all in one fell swoop. So the plan falls apart. Goes down to defeat. You know, it was included in there, you know, in the 1,300-page Clinton plan, whatever it was, this was part of it, but it goes down to dramatic defeat. So the question is, what happens next? So then the next thing that happens is government says, all right, in effect, we're out, you know, when it comes to regulating the medical workforce, we're out of it. What happens next is you have the rise of managed care. In the mid-1990s, and we've talked about this earlier, in the mid-1990s, you had a dramatic expansion in the role that managed care played here in the United States. Dramatic expansion in the role of managed care. We talked about that 2 weeks ago, I guess it was, two, 3 weeks ago. As managed care grew, advocates for managed care argued that managed care is going to solve the problem of specialty maldistribution, and it's going to solve it through markets, not through the government. Why would that be? Why do you think that argument was made? Because the assumption was that managed care plans themselves were going to shape and change the medical marketplace. They were going to hire fewer anesthesiologists for their networks. They were going to rely more on primary care physicians. They were going to be required to deliver services through their entire delivery system and therefore would deal with geographic maldistribution. And indeed, if you look over the last decade at surveys of graduating medical students. And if you look at some of the specialties these days, it is tougher and tougher to enter certain specialties. You do have a rising number of graduating medical students these days expressing an interest in primary and generalist careers. And so the jury is still out. There are some who suggest that the managed care revolution has begun to inch away at the problem of specialty maldistribution all by itself, without government. It's a little too soon to tell, and the fact that there's a whole host of other confounding variables, particularly around lifestyle. I mean, more and more graduating medical students want regular sort of 9-to-5 or sort of regular hours in their jobs. And instead of going out and joining a 2- or 3-person group, they don't mind the idea of sort of joining a large managed care plan, being a generalist physician, but not being on call 24 hours a day, and having control over their schedule, you know, in a way that an individual solo practice or even a small group practice would not give them. So the jury is out on that, but what is clear is that the problem of geographic maldistribution just keeps getting worse. Just keeps getting worse. The number of medical underserved communities in the United States is growing. And that's not just rural. It's not just rural communities. It's inner city communities as well, which don't, in theory, have as great a problem recruiting as do the rural areas, and yet the number of medical underserved communities, even in urban areas, is growing. It is increasingly difficult, despite all of the ideas that you guys came up with and that states have been trying, it is increasingly difficult to find a medical workforce that's able and willing to work in medically underserved communities here in the United States. And that's a problem. I mean, that's a big problem. Managed, yeah. Clearly, again, it's hard to say exactly what proportion it's due. Clearly, that's part of the story. I mean, clearly, that's part of the story. You know, Medicaid pays particularly, not only Medicaid, but private insurance pays very low for primary care generalist care. And what rural areas need more than anything is primary care generalists. You know, most rural areas could not themselves support, you know, a neurosurgeon. I mean, you don't need a neurosurgeon in, you know, a small farming community in Indiana in the local small hospital. You know, you need sort of regional hospitals. I mean, if you really think about sort of planning, you need regional hospitals, you know, in sort of the Indianapolises or the Lincoln, Nebraskas, or the, you know, where people can be taken when they need sort of the really high-tech stuff. But you need generalists in local communities, whether it's nurse practitioners or whether it's primary care physicians or whoever it is. In primary care, whether it's by Medicaid or by private insurance, is significantly underpaid, at least compared to the specialties, and that's still the case. So there's no question that's part of the story.
Not to mention that Medicaid only reimburses nurse practitioners 85% of what they reimburse doctors, and then reimburses midwives 65%.
Too. Yeah, well, that's, and amazingly enough, that's actually an improvement over what it used to be. I mean, there was a long time when Medicaid wouldn't reimburse non-physician providers at all, zero. You know, and again, and that's sort of part of the argument that the nurse practitioners were making during the Clinton, you know, during the debate over the Clinton plan. They were saying, you know, if you really want to plot and plan and sort of, you know, come up with a rational system here, you would rely more, you would pay more and rely more on non-physician providers and have fewer generalist docs and more specialists. So another impact that managed care has in the mid-1990s, is managed care and the movement that we talked about, was it last week, toward Medicaid managed care. Managed care presents the opportunity for public health departments around the country to exit the direct services, the direct care services world. As Medicaid moves to managed care, many public health agencies say, we want to get out of the business of providing direct care. We're going to let the managed care plans take care of providing direct care services to the low-income people in our community. And so whether it's Westchester County, whether it's New York City, lots of communities, lots of health departments around the country say, we want to get out of the business of providing primary care and spend more time thinking about, particularly with the rise of AIDS and TB and obesity and all these issues they want to deal with, we want to get back to our original mission of public health services. And again, there's a real split to this day among public health departments as to whether or not they should be in the business of providing direct care services, particularly primary care and child care services, or not. If you go to Seattle, if you go to Boston, if you go to San Francisco, and you talk to the health commissioners in those cities, they will say, we are in direct care services and we want to stay in direct care services because we make money from those services that we use to subsidize our other public health services. If you talk to other public health commissioners around the country, they'll say, we got out of direct care services because it was a drain on our financing, it was a drain on our funding, and it was diverting us from our core public health mission. Ongoing debate, ongoing controversy, ongoing issue in the world of public health. Enter into that arena the whole debate over emergency preparedness and bioterror preparedness. Prior to September 11th, 2001, prior to the anthrax scare in 2001, October of 2001, public health departments across the country did very, very, very little when it came to emergency preparedness, disaster preparedness, bioterror preparedness. Very little. Certainly it's true that if you were a public health department in an area that was hit consistently by hurricanes or had earthquakes on occasion or where there was a nuclear reactor on site in your community, there might be more attention paid to those particular issues, earthquakes, hurricanes, nuclear reactors, than the typical public health department across the country. But generally speaking, emergency preparedness, disaster preparedness was viewed as an issue to be dealt with by police, by fire, by other sort of EMT types. Those were the first responders. Those would be the first responders. It was not considered to be a public health department issue. That was a whole third area. Remember, area number one is sort of the classic epidemiological public health surveillance. Area number two is public health departments getting involved in the direct care services. Area number three is emergency preparedness. And that was an area that health departments across the country basically ignored. Not only local health departments, but government more generally basically ignored the question of emergency preparedness. Government more generally ignored the question of a possible bioterror or chemical attack. 1993, the World Trade Center here in New York was attacked. It was like one or two people killed. I mean, there was a few people killed. It wasn't obviously the same as what happened in 2001, but there was an attack on the World Trade Center in 1993. That was viewed primarily as a criminal act, not as an act of terrorism. Nobody even knew in 1993 what Al-Qaeda was, who Osama bin Laden was. You know, I mean, that was all sort of just a whole different era, a whole different world. And certainly it was a world that public health departments, when the World Trade Center was attacked in 93, it was police, it was FBI, it was fire who responded. 1995, two things happened that gave some pause to policymakers here in the United States. First and most obviously is that on April 19th, I think it was, 1995, what happened on April 19th, 1995? Oklahoma City bombing took place. And that really had an impact. That really suggested, almost for the first time, that here in the United States, there could be a major terrorist attack which would require a significant first responder activity by a host of both police, fire, and other responders. But again, it was primarily police, fire, and criminal FBI organizations, you know, and that responded. You know, local health departments played, they were there, but they played clearly a secondary role. There was also some nerve gas released in Japan on a train, on a subway in Japan. In 1995, there were the first instances where there actually were becoming fears that there could be a bioterror attack here in the United States. In response, following the Oklahoma attack, Oklahoma City attack in 1995, Congress in 1996 enacted for the first time, it enacted legislation that was designed in part to give some money to local health departments to do some preparation work for a bioterror attack. Congress in 1996 enacted a law called the Defense Against Weapons with Mass Destruction Act. And that law provided about $36 million to the Department of Defense and about $6 million to the Department of Health and Human Services. The $6 million that the Department of Health and Human Services got was to be divided up among about 125 cities across the country. And what those cities were supposed to use, that $6 million, or that total, the whole thing was $6 million. What they were supposed to do was create teams, rapid response teams, and New York City got some money, Westchester, you know, big cities got this money, to create these rapid response teams to sort of plan for, you know, decontamination efforts and sort of rapid response to terrorist attack activities. $6 million to 125 cities across the country is nothing. There's absolutely nothing. And basically what cities did that got that money was they just designated one or two of their staff to come up with the plan. You know, and they now had a plan on the books in theory. But it was, while it was the first, again, it was interesting because it was immediately post-Oklahoma City. It was 1996. And it was the first effort by Congress to even inch toward giving state and local public health departments money on the recognition that the health departments of the United States might have an important role to play if there was a bioterror attack. But the amount of money was so small and so insignificant that it was viewed simply by the local public health departments as, you know, the source of a few bucks, but no change in real policy, no change in real activity. 1998, and this, I have to confess, I'm not 100% sure is true, but I like to believe it's true, the story I've told you. So I'm going to tell you, and you can believe it or not believe it. I interviewed, as part of a project that I've been working on, one of Clinton's top aides. And I asked him, in 1999, Congress enacted another piece of legislation to give additional money to deal with a potential bioterror attack. And according to this advisor, in late 1998, Clinton went up to Camp David and read a book. And the book that he read was called The Cobra Event, I think, by, I'm forgetting the name of the author right now. But it's a novel. And it's a novel about a bioterror attack in a subway in New York City. And so Clinton reads this novel, and the next day he calls in this advisor who told me the story, and one other person. I mean, it was one of Clinton's top sort of science and bioterror advisors. And he calls this guy into his office, and he said, "I just read this book. Couldn't this happen? You know, is this pure fiction, or is there some, you know, could this happen?" And the advisor said, he told him, it could happen. You know, that obviously it was sensationalized, it was a novel, it wasn't quite, you know, the way it would all play out, but that, yes, indeed, there was something to be worried about there. And so at that point, Clinton gave these two advisors 48 hours to come up with some legislation and a proposal to deal with this problem, which they did, which they then presented, which then Clinton gave a speech on, at the Naval Academy, about a week or two later. I may have the time. I mean, I've sort of had this whole chronology. I may have this a little bit off. But Clinton then gives a speech, again, which is all sort of prompted by this. He then presents legislation to Congress. And in 1999, as a result of this, Clinton gets Congress to allocate $121 million for bioterror preparation, half of which the CDC used to create something called the Strategic National Stockpile. So about $60 million was used to create sort of a national stockpile of Cipro or other drugs to be used as, you know, antidotes if some, you know, anthrax was, you know, some bioterror attack took place. No, just to create and then to put in secure places around the country stockpiles of these medicines and other drugs. So that, and that's even today, I mean, not even, in 2006, that's probably the federal government's main protective device. It's the Strategic National Stockpile, which they're trying to build up, you know, to deal with a potential attack. And the other $60 million was given to state and local health departments to begin to think about bioterrorism preparedness activities. Now, again, you have to remember, public health departments in 1999, the last thing on their agenda was bioterror preparedness. The last thing on their agenda was, I mean, they were worried about should they be in the direct care business or not the direct care business. They were worried about should they be doing more to deal with, you know, AIDS and HIV. Should they be doing more to deal with TB? Should they be doing more to deal with crises in schools? How could they get more epidemiologists? How could they, you know, get young public health students? How could they build up their labs? How could they build up their workforce? How could they build up their communication system? How could they build up their information system? Those were, if you talk to commissioners of health, that was their agenda. Their agenda was not, what do we do if, you know, there's a bomb at the World Trade Center? Or if somebody delivers 100, you know, letters filled with anthrax to 100 different people? Or somebody drops something in the subway, that was not on the radar screen. So a little bit of money comes in, and some health departments, and New York City was clearly in the lead here, some health departments were big enough, were savvy enough, were sophisticated enough to say, all right, we could take the money, and we can really begin to assign some people to think about some of these things. But you know what? How many public health departments do you think there are across the United States? Somebody want to take a guess? 395. Anybody else have a guess? That's low. 500. 1,000. 2,000. You win. There are over 3,000 local public health departments in the United States. Over 3,000 of them. Most of those 3,000 local public health departments have a director or a commissioner who's not a physician, who has never been to a school of public health, you know, who basically is running, you know, has a running a direct care, is probably a nurse, you know, and is providing services to local school kids in that community, and may well be doing very good work. You know, I mean, a lot of these health centers do very good work, if you define very good work as providing, you know, immunizations and other services like that to local school kids. But the last thing that that local health department official is going to think about is, you know, being involved in emergency preparedness, emergency response, bioterror preparedness. So that's 1999, about $60 million, you know, for these local health departments, most of which goes to sort of the few big New York City, San Francisco health departments. Yeah. Well, that's the question was, and that's probably one of the biggest questions that is on the agenda today, is how, and we're going to get to that question either today or soon thereafter. But the question is, how should bioterror money be allocated? Should it be allocated based largely by population across the country, or should it be allocated based upon risk, threat of risk? And that's one of the most controversial issues on the agenda today, so I want to come back to that issue. I mean, what the folks in Nebraska would say, just to pick on Nebraska for one more time, is that, I mean, what Michael Bloomberg says is, you know what, New York City is the obvious target. New York City should get all, you know, all the federal money to the extent there is federal money, and Nebraska, you know, where the small towns, which now are getting a lot more money per capita than New York City is, are getting way too much money. What the Nebraska folks would say is, you know what, when there's 100,000 people at a Nebraska football game, that is a target. When there's, you know, water supply sites in rural upstate New York, that is a target. That it's very hard to think about the obvious targets versus the non-obvious targets. But that's an important issue that we're going to come back to. Yeah.
Talk about New Jersey. There's tension from New York City and New Jersey. There's at least one nuclear power plant, not two. There are nuclear power plants across the country where there's a concern that if that were to be hit, devastation could
right.
be, you know, that's
absolutely.
There goes the Eastern Seaboard type thing. You know?
Right.
There's concern about that.
No, it's true. I mean, and if Jack Bauer only really exists on TV, you know, then we're on. So in the year 2000, actually in an effort to begin to get at your question, in the year 2000, so 99, Congress passes the law, $120 million that I just talked about. In the year 2000, meanwhile, Clinton is increasingly worried about this. And he asks Dick Clark and other of his sort of high officials who were sort of doing this kind of, working on this stuff for him. I mean, now he knows all about Osama bin Laden. Now he knows all about Al-Qaeda. And so what the national security folks do in 2000 is they conduct three sort of pretend attacks. You know, one in New Hampshire, one in Denver, I think, and one in Washington, D.C. Three sort of pretend, and I forget exactly what it was, but three bioterror attacks, and in which all of a sudden, you know, people or victims are like flooding local hospitals, you know, and the attacks show, you know, there's a potential for huge disaster here. I mean, it becomes clear that the health system, that the public health system, that the medical system, that the police system, that the fire department system, the emergency responders are no way ready to know what signs they should be looking for, and that in these sort of exercises, known as the top-off exercises, and these exercises, you know, hundreds of thousands of people die overnight, you know, in ways, and panic ensues, and all sorts of terrible things happen. And so Clark and others conduct these exercises, and they say, you know what, we have a real problem here. We have a potential real problem. In the year 2000, Clinton goes back to Congress and says, you know what, we've just done these exercises, you know, the last few months, and we're totally unprepared for a mass attack on the United States, and it could happen. And he asks for a lot more money. And in 2000, Congress actually authorizes $540 million for bioterror preparedness, although it ends up actually appropriating less than half of that. So inch by inch, we're doing more, a little bit more, a little bit more, a little bit more. You know, again, we went from zero before 1996 to 6 million in 96 to 120 million, half of the feds, half of the states in 99 to 540 million appropriated, I mean, authorized, but about 250 million appropriated in 2000. But again, this is not an issue on the national agenda. You know, Brokaw, Jennings, rather, they're not talking about these issues. You know, that's not on the national news. This is sort of a inside the Beltway debate between Washington politicians. There's a few commissions. I mean, there are some folks, you know, John McCain, and there are a few others who begin to talk about some of this stuff. But it's really a sort of a low-key behind the Beltway issue. Obviously, then, you have September 11, 2001, and you have shortly thereafter, through the post office, the mailing of anthrax to some newscasters and journalists, and some people die in post offices and other places, and of course, 3,000 or so die either at the Trade Center or in Pennsylvania. At that point, obviously, the threat both of a terror attack and a bioterror attack all of a sudden, instantly, completely on the agenda. One of the things that is immediately noticeable here in New York City on September 11th, 12th, 13th, and 14th of 2001 is that the New York City Health Department becomes a key player in post-9/11 activities. Most health departments across the country would not have been equipped and able to do some of the kind of things that New York City did immediately after 9/11, because New York City has the biggest, most sophisticated, and fanciest, and best health department in the country, by most accounts, and certainly I think that's the case. But New York City, largely, the health department largely demonstrated that indeed, in an attack like that, there are public health actions that need to be taken, whether it's, you know, examining the food supply in Lower Manhattan, whether it's examining the air, whether it's examining the rodents and sort of what's going on with that, whether it's examining the health of workers. I mean, there's just a host of activities which are classic public health activities, which the New York City Health Department takes the lead on. All of a sudden, there's a recognition, and then, of course, with anthrax, it's clearly health departments, although there's a debate. I mean, health departments get around the country with the anthrax scare and attack. Health departments around the country get inundated with phone calls saying there's a white powder that's been found, you know, 99% of which turn out to be, you know, false. But inundated with fear, with upset, with concern, with crank calls, you know, people deliberately, you know, making sort of fake calls, deliberately sort of setting things up. I mean, and health departments all of a sudden are overwhelmed with tasks dealing with potential bioterror attack toward the end of 2001. Early in 2002, Congress passes another law, sort of a post-9/11 law, and this time they allocate, you know, about $1 billion to health departments, primarily to health departments, and another few hundred million to hospitals. But a lot of money is allocated to local health departments to do bioterror preparedness activities. A lot of money. Health departments now say to themselves and begin to become split. Some health departments say, you know what? Our infrastructure has been falling apart for the last 30 years. We have not had enough labs. We have not had enough workers. We have not had enough epidemiologists. We have not had enough information systems. We've not had enough computers. We've not had enough walkie-talkies. We've not had enough systems. We've been, you know, barely surviving, and this huge infusion of federal dollars could well save and salvage the public health system here in the United States, say some health department officials. Other health department officials say, you know what, this is dangerous, dangerous money we're talking about taking. This is money that is going to, in effect, convert us to sub-agents of the Department of Homeland Security, we're going to be sort of part of a police-military response. We're going to have our agenda set for us by the federal government. We're going to be diverted. I mean, the Commissioner of Health in Seattle claims, and has claimed publicly, that, and we'll get to this probably next week, but that the federally mandated effort to inoculate hundreds of thousands of folks with a smallpox inoculated vaccine, which turned out to be a huge fiasco, that whole smallpox vaccine initiative, the Commissioner of Health of Seattle claims diverted Seattle from catching in a timely fashion an outbreak of TB in Seattle. Whether he's right or wrong, who knows? I mean, I suppose he's right. He would know. But, you know, the claim is that among some health commissioners that their priorities were now going to be set by sort of federal Department of Homeland Security officials and the White House, not local health needs of their particular local community. Big split in the local public health community over whether or not this money coming in, and $1 billion a year to local public health departments is a huge infusion of money for these public health departments. Let me mention three big issues around this money. One issue was actually brought up earlier, and that issue is how should this money be divvied up across the country? The way Congress did it at first was they said, let me actually make sure I get this right, sort of right. They said that every state gets a minimum of how much money was it? You know, whether you're Nebraska or New York, every state, plus four cities, New York City, LA, Washington, D.C., and Chicago, they get $5 million. So plus, and then the rest of the money is allocated based on population. Yeah.
Is that $5 million aggregate or each?
Each state gets, I mean, there's, no, just five, for the state, there's $5 million. You know, so you take, if there's 50 states, that's $250 million right there. Then you got four cities that are getting $5 million. So $270 million is essentially divided up equally. And the other several hundred million dollars is divided up by population. That formula results in small rural states getting a lot more per capita than large states like New York or California. And it generates a huge debate over whether or not that's just pork barrel politics in which, you know, senators and congressmen from smaller states, you know, want to bring in this new federal money to their state, and so this is just a way of protecting them, or in contrast, if in fact, you know, there's significant risks in all states around the country and they all need to be doing things. So one of the debates I want you to think about is sort of risk-based allocation versus population-based allocation. Second big issue has to do with what's known as dual use. Health department officials around the country basically said, you know what, we're going to get this money for bioterror preparedness, but whatever we do to prepare for a potential bioterror attack should also help us if there's a natural disaster, if there's a hurricane, if there's an earthquake, if there's an outbreak of SARS, if there's an outbreak of swine flu, if there's a avian flu outbreak, that we should have an ability to use this money both to prepare for natural disasters and for bioterror or chemical disasters. How money gets used and whether it's used for dual use or whether it's, you know, how the money used becomes extremely controversial. That's a second issue to think about. Third issue to think about is states, now this money comes into the states. It's a big infusion of money comes into the states. Comes into the states at exactly the same moment when states are in the midst of big budget deficits. Remember, late 90s, about every state was struggling with a huge budget deficit and budget crisis. Under the law, the states are not allowed to supplant state money with this new federal money. And the local counties are not allowed to supplant county money with this new federal money. In other words, if you've got an epidemiologist on your staff and you've been paying that epidemiologist with county money, now that you have this grant from the federal government, you're not supposed to basically use the federal money to pay the epidemiologist, you know, and tell your mayor that you don't need that money anymore. Because then there's really nothing new going on. You're just substituting federal dollars for local or state dollars. That's illegal under the law. However, there's a big question or a big debate, particularly in an era when states are cutting back their funding for local health departments, which most states in the country were cutting back in the late 90s. There's a question about whether or not supplantation took place, and if so, how much and with what results. Did you have a question?
Well, just to say good luck proving it.
Right. So what I want you to do for next week, I ask you to read, there's a couple of reports that were put out by Trust for America and a couple other people, sort of summarizing what's happened over the last couple of years to this new infusion of federal money. What I want to do next week is we're going to start out, remember, with Bob Challoner, when you're all going to be here, talking about health information technology. Then I want to talk a little bit more about some of these questions around bioterror preparedness, and I want to bring up Katrina. And I want to bring up sort of preparedness around Katrina as part of that conversation. Why do I feel like no one's even listening to me anymore? I feel like this talk, but no one's listening. And then we'll just take it from there. All right, you can go. Thanks.